The top stories. Palestinians say a U.S. brokered normalization deal between Israel and Morocco will increase Israel's belligerence and its denial of the Palestinian people's rights. Iran criticizes Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan for reciting a poem deemed to be aimed at undermining the Iranian territorial integrity. Also this hour, Germany reports a record number of nearly 30,000 coronavirus cases and almost 600 new deaths from the virus. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Palestinians have condemned a U.S. brokered normalization agreement between Morocco and Israel. Palestine Liberation Organization called Morocco's decision unacceptable. It said the move will increase Israel's belligerence and its denial of the Palestinian people's rights. Resistance movement Hamas said Israel uses every new normalization deal to increase its aggression against Palestinians. U.S. President Donald Trump announced the agreement on Twitter on Thursday. Morocco is the fourth Arab state to normalize ties with Israel since August. Three others to do so were Bahrain, the UAE, and Sudan. White House senior advisor Jared Kushner has said a similar deal is inevitable between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Mona Kandil in occupied Ramallah says Palestinians regard Morocco's normalization of ties with Israel as a betrayal of their cause.
Well, the Palestinians keep receiving more stabs in the back as the Palestinian Authority and all the Palestinians with their different political affiliation. There was United Arab Emirates, then Bahrain, Sudan, and now we are speaking about Morocco. Palestinians angrily denounce Moroccan betrayal over Israel move. It seems that according to the Palestinians, these Arab states are preferring their personal, of course, interests over the Palestinian cause, because it's well known that Morocco is one of the countries that supports the Palestinians and have a great friendship with the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian people. But Palestinians today say it doesn't mean that the people of Morocco supports normalization with the Israeli regime and the Israeli occupation. However, it's a game, and there is a mutual interest between Morocco and Israel.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has criticized Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan for reciting a controversial poem on Iran's territorial integrity. Zarif said Erdogan was uninformed that what he ill-recited refers to the forcible separation of areas north of Arast from the Iranian motherland. The top Iranian diplomat said no one can ask or speak ill of Iran's northwestern region of Azerbaijan. He also accused the Turkish leader of undermining the sovereignty of the Republic of Azerbaijan. On Thursday, Erdogan started his speech at a military parade in Baku with an old poem. The poet had lamented what he called the forcible separation of Azerbaijan from Iran based on Golestan and Turkmenchai treaties. They were concluded between the Russian Empire and Iran's Qajar dynasty more than two centuries ago. The treaty saw areas north of the Aras River separate from Iran. Political commentator Dr. Mahmoud Marandi says Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has never shown true friendship towards the Iranian people.
I think what Dr. Zarif said was quite generous, and that the intentions of President Erdogan, unfortunately, were not benign. And the problem with President Erdogan is that despite the fact that Iran helped him from the very beginning to come to power in Turkey, mm-hmm. and helped him when the coup was about to overthrow his government, despite that, President Erdogan has never really showed true friendship towards the Iranian people, let alone the people across the region. Unfortunately, when he came to power, he kept his strong relations with Israel. The Israeli regime has an embassy in Turkey. They have direct flights. They do business together. Despite the rhetoric and despite some Turks being killed in the flotilla by the Israeli regime, I think 10 Turks were killed, he maintained those relations. So the hypocrisy that he's shown over the years, whether it's in supporting ISIS and Al-Qaeda and working with NATO in Syria, whether it was supporting Saudi Arabia during the initial years in the genocide in Yemen, and the subjugation of the people of Bahrain, he supported that as well, the crushing of their dissent. Across the board, his policies have been horrible.
A senior Yemeni official has condemned U.S. sanctions against some officials of the country's National Salvation Government, calling them an act of terrorism. Mohammed Ali Al-Houthi said the sanctions are illegal, since the U.S. has no right to impose restrictions on other nations. The Ansarullah official also denounced Washington for leading aggression and attacks on Yemeni people and neglecting Security Council orders. Earlier, the U.S. Treasury blacklisted five Yemeni officials who cooperate with the country's security and intelligence services. Human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says the U.S. has a hypocritical view on terrorism and only cares about selling arms.
You know, over 233,000 people killed in Yemen. It's the world's largest man-made humanitarian crisis. And, you know, the United States, you know, is totally hypocritical. You know, when Saudi Arabia kills Jamal Khashoggi and chops off his body and does it, and he's a permanent resident of the United States and a reporter for the Washington Post, the Americans, Donald Trump says, that's okay, we're not interested. We're more interested in selling arms to Saudi Arabia. In the United States, there are laws which prevent the use of American arms for uses of aggression. And Saudi Arabia and UAE are using American-made weapons in, you know, forms of aggression against the people of Yemen. But the Americans were, this is terrorism they like. If terrorism, on whatever scale it is, if it's done by their friends, it's not a problem. But if it's done by somebody who they don't like for political reasons, or maybe for reasons of American domestic policy, they condemn them as being terrorists. It's all political. They spin it for what they want. And as long as they can make money selling arms and trying to create chaos and taking advantage of those opportunities, you know, they're happy. And the congressmen make lots of money because they invest in the military-industrial complex, and they know in advance who's going to get the big contracts, so the stock's going to go up or go down.
The ongoing investigation into the assassination of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi has provided a new twist. A U.S. judge has demanded that intelligence services disclose any evidence on the case to a New York court within 14 days.
It's one of the world's worst-kept secrets, but evidence pointing to the involvement of the Saudi regime into the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi has been kept hidden from the public domain based on intelligence service requests. However, for the first time since the assassination of the journalist in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, a U.S. judge has ordered the partial disclosure of any evidence held by the U.S. intelligence agencies to be delivered to a New York court within a fortnight. It's most likely that the judge in question, Paul Engelmeyer, is referring to a list of exhibits linked to the murder, and in particular to a tape recording of the incident in which the sound of Khashoggi and the perpetrators of the crime can be heard. Already, the CIA have concluded that the murder was approved by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, although not actually present at the time of the killing, but was more than likely the one who ordered and oversaw the operation taking place.
What I do have is evidence suggesting that the responsibilities of high-level officials may be engaged and therefore is requiring further investigation, in particular of the Crown Prince, for a variety of reasons. The first one is that the people directly implicated in the murder reported to him. So there is a reporting line here that needs to be further investigated.
With the court taking such a step, it could be the first phase in ousting those truly responsible for the murder, and more importantly, removing the cloak of immunity that Bin Salman, for one, is happy to hide behind, hence finally demanding some notion of accountability.
It's a state killing. And as such, it is important that the state of Saudi Arabia be held accountable. So far, there has been no move on the part of the international community to treat the execution of Mr. Khashoggi as something that was sponsored, incited, ordered by the state.
What now remains to be seen is whether the likes of the CIA and other agencies in the US will obey the court order, Or will they too hide behind the veil of national security interests in order to protect the likes of Bin Salman from finally being brought to justice?
Well, the Saudi Crown Prince is, of course, no stranger to other similar crimes. Check this out, having been accused of sending a hit squad to Canada, detaining Saudi royals, as well as potentially playing a role alongside the Israeli regime in the assassination of prominent Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. However, with the current U.S. president and key ally of Bin Salman likely to be leaving office in January, will the future U.S. government provide as much protection towards Bin Salman as the previous one?
It seems that the young and inexperienced Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has allowed the power to go to his head, already forging a negative reputation for himself, as demonstrated in his range of recklessly backed actions since taking the position of Crown Prince. Yet could his actions now be coming back to haunt him? With the order by the US court to expose the tapes surrounding the murder, could the heavily cash-influenced and petrodollar relationship between the US and the Saudi regime be turning sour? Bin Salman's also been accused of sending a murder hit squad to Canada to assassinate former Saudi intelligence official Saad al-Jabri, something that Bin Salman strongly denies, yet all the evidence points towards the favoured modus operandi of the Crown Prince following the foiling of the plot by the Canadian security services. There's also speculation that Bin Salman met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a secret meeting just prior to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. However, the meeting has been denied, yet somehow suggests that Bin Salman was aware and briefed about the Israeli regime plot to murder on Iranian soil. But there's a saving grace for Bin Salman, namely the protection he enjoys from the current US President, Donald Trump. Following the murder of Khashoggi, Trump was happy to turn a blind eye to the event, likely dazed by the wads of cash flowing in from Saudi Arabia to the US through arms deals and more.
We also have a great ally in Saudi Arabia. They give us a lot of jobs, they give us a lot of business, a lot of economic development.
What now remains to be seen is whether the president-elect, Joe Biden, will be as accommodating towards Bin Salman as his predecessor, and if not, will Bin Salman survive without Uncle Donald by his side?
Russia has denounced new U.S. sanctions against a number of Russian entities, saying they will deepen a crisis in bilateral ties.
The actions of the U.S. administration are just another unfriendly and detrimental move against Russia, which will deepen the crisis in bilateral relations. The allegations that Russian officials are responsible for human rights violations are groundless and beneath criticism.
Russian ambassador called the sanctions an attempt by the U.S. to distract public attention from its own problems. The new measures target a number of Russian officials and firms over what the U.S. calls links to the Chechen leader. The measures were announced by the U.S. Treasury Department on Thursday. It has accused the targeted entities of human rights violations, including torture. The U.S. had previously blacklisted Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov on similar accusations. Now, COVID-19 hospitalizations keep soaring in the U.S., even affecting patients who do not have the disease. Official figures show COVID hospitalizations reached a record high of 107,200 on Thursday. The figures also show corona patients occupied nearly half of all staffed ICU beds last week. That was up from 37% in the first week of November. Government data show one-third of all U.S. hospitals are almost out of ICU space. Doctors say the impact is not just on people with COVID, it's on anybody who needs hospital care. The U.S. has the largest coronavirus case tally in the world, at nearly 15.6 million cases. Its total deaths are above 292,000. COVID-19 is surging across Europe as well, with several countries on the continent reporting a steep rise in cases and fatalities. Germany has recorded nearly 30,000 new coronavirus cases and 598 new deaths over the past 24 hours. The total case number now stands at over 1,270,000, and the death toll is nearly 21,000. Russia has reported a record 613 deaths related to the virus in the last 24 hours, taking its official death toll from the pandemic to nearly 45,900. Authorities confirmed over 28,500 new cases in nationally, that is, pushing the national case total to nearly 2,600,000. Over to Ukraine, the number of daily coronavirus deaths there rose to 285. Officials said that 13,500 new coronavirus cases were recorded in the past 24 hours, bringing the total number to over 872,000 cases, with nearly 14,800 deaths. In other news, European Union leaders have resolved a dispute with Hungary and Poland and salvaged the bloc's post-coronavirus recovery plan.
We could say, modestly, of course, that we saved the unity of the Union. So don't forget that this dispute was not only about the rule of law regulation, financial issue, but it was about the future of European Union.
The Hungarian premier said the deal with the EU is only one step and there is another difficult obstacle. He said that is the ratification of the agreement by the Hungarian parliament. Orbán's Polish counterpart, Matthias Morawiecki, that should be called the agreement of victory. The deal followed several weeks of dispute between the two countries and other EU member states. Poland and Hungary had vetoed the budget plan over provisions linking it to the respect for rule of law. The plan is vital for Europe as it is struggling with the economic fallout of the pandemic. The United States reportedly plans to impose sanctions on Turkey over Russian S-400 air defense systems Ankara received last year. Reuters says the sanctions would target Turkey's presidency of defense industries and its head. The news agency has cited several U.S. sources, including three officials, for its report. They have said the measures, that is, would be announced as early as Friday. The Turkish lira weakened as much as 1.4% following the news. A senior Turkish official said the sanctions would backfire and hurt ties with the U.S. Ankara started receiving the Russian S-400s in July of last year and tested them as recently as October. In response, the U.S. said it was removing Turkey from its F-35 fighter jet program. The European Union plans more sanctions against Turkey as well over its gas exploration activities in disputed Mediterranean waters. EU leaders decided at a Thursday summit to prepare a list of Turkish targets for the sanctions. A diplomat said individuals responsible for drilling in the contested waters are among those to be targeted. The diplomat said Turkey could even face more sanctions if it pursues actions considered provocative by the EU. The bloc's member state, Greece, has been at odds with Turkey since August. That's when Turkey sent an exploration ship to Mediterranean waters claimed by Greece. Athens says Turkish activities violate its territory. Turkey rejects this and says it's not concerned about EU sanctions. And that's it with international news.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
In Iran, you see restaurants serving unlimited amounts of bread next to whatever meal one might order. And the yogurt and cheese to go with the bread don't normally come plain. Rose petal, pistachios, and walnuts blend well if you know how to apply them.
Correct. We are here to talk about Iran's agricultural resources today. Agricultural sustainability and independence, rather, in the face of U.S. maximum pressure sanctions. Because, yes, the sanctions are still in place, and they're even affecting food and drug availability. Stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today to see how Iran, this mini-continent of four seasons, is doing.
We'll be right back. Iran's present situation is fine for the short term, but longer-term planning is a must to maintain and improve suitable arable water levels and soil quality, foreign policy, and people's purchasing power. Disjointed as these factors may sound, they all come together to make for foodstuff availability and security, and a lucrative food industry. Mr. Kianirad is in a position to plan strategy for the country's agricultural sector and market. He explains the tenets of a successful chain, beginning with production and ending in consumption.
Food security has four main pillars. The first pillar of the debate is availability, meaning that food must be available in the required amount. It goes without saying that the agricultural sector needs resources and agricultural components to produce food, perhaps the most important of which are basic resources such as soil, water, biodiversity, and other factors of production, including the productive components, machinery, and so on.
Aye, for as long as produce is delivered to the market on time and not hoarded to raise prices, and for as long as people can afford it, there still is enough crop yielded to keep stomachs full and keep Iranian cuisine alive. The FAO announced the production of over 21.5 million tons of grain in Iran during the last crop year, and announced that Iran is ranked 9th in the world in terms of grain reserves. Achieving this rank while the country is exposed to drought is commendable. With 17th place in terms of population in the world, Iran has 1.1% of the world's grain reserves. Mr. Khalilian is a former agriculture minister. He has some figures handy to present.
Fortunately, during the 4 decades since the Islamic Republic was founded, we have been able to meet more than 80% of our agricultural needs and food. Especially on products such as wheat, we have managed to become relatively self-sufficient for some years. In the years when we faced drought, we met at least 80% of our wheat needs from the inside. In the field of dairy products, rice, and some other strategic products, we have been able to achieve relative self-sufficiency and even managed to export $5 to $6 billion a year in various agricultural products.
The wheat harvest has actually decreased by 500,000 tons in the last crop year. However, the rice harvest has increased by 200,000 tons and other grains have grown by 200,000 tons as well. Iran's staple diet is wheat, barley, and rice. Mizrafi saves room for praise for improvement. She's on the Parliamentary Agricultural Committee and has the qualification to amend the legal system to improve Iran's status in the sector.
Unfortunately, we are over 70% dependent on inputs. This is not called strategic agriculture for a country. When we have to import seeds, when we have to import pesticides and fertilizers to a large extent, we have to import livestock and fish feed inputs. This means incomplete and improper planning in the field of agriculture.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, had estimated the area under wheat cultivation in Iran would increase slightly in 2020. Plantation area is around 6 million hectares right now. Iran is basically on the Iranian plateau and is at high altitude. The country comprises 14% arable land, 8% forest, and 55% natural pastures, and 23% desert. The pastures are non-arable, by the way.
One of the major projects undertaken in the Islamic Republic was the Agricultural Development Project, which we have been pursuing since 2010. We provided 9 trillion tomans of cheap credits and facilities to farmers, and we also helped new investors to invest in various fields with low-interest facilities.
In March 2020, the government announced its plans to purchase nearly 75% of the domestic wheat production. The aim was to eliminate the reliance on imports for domestic consumption. With all the talk of domestic consumption, it's easy to lose sight of the importance of exports. Now, sanctions may well be in the way of exports, and what a shame, given Iran's high-quality, varied produce. Before going on to exports, however, I would like to tend more to the importance of improving the farming and agriculture sector.
That can be helped by foreign investment and introducing more technology into farming in Iran. Having managed, followed and managed water resources, however.
As per any sector, exports must move, however, from raw sales to the sale of processed material and standardly packed, preferably organic foodstuff and food products. Mr. Sheikhi is an economist who can list as many impediments to exports as there are letters in the alphabet. Here are some of those reasons.
Unfortunately, Iran has a very small share in the global agricultural market, which is also a lucrative one. This is because, unfortunately, we have not, and still do not have, an integrated trade policy system based on the model of a resistive economy. I will mention some of the problems here on a case-by-case basis. One of the problems is bureaucracy. The second is a lack of coordination between organs. And furthermore, we don't have a specific body that is responsible for the export of agricultural products.
The government had wanted to attract $8 billion over 4 years by foreign investment in the agricultural sector. That was before the 2015 JCPOA or nuclear deal, which would have facilitated just that by lifting sanctions off Iran in return for this country limiting its peaceful nuclear program. But before the contents of the deal could materialize, the U.S. pulled out and reimposed and reinforced economic nuclear-related U.N. sanctions as U.S. sanctions.
Foreign investment in our country has not been very successful. There are several reasons for that, some of which are internal and others external and out of our control. Internal reasons include the problem of bureaucratic processes in the country, which makes it somewhat difficult to invest. I can use the term self-sanctioning to describe it. The issue of foreign sanctions has also had its impacts. More important than sanctions is the issue of investment security and the feeling of investment security. We are the safest country in the Middle East. Some admit this, some do not. But the media propaganda tries to undermine the perception of this security.
As for exports again, Iran's share in the international market is pretty low in spite of its present resources and future potential. Its share in the global market is at under 5%. FAO says threats should be turned around into opportunities to turn small-scale farming into macro farming. The infrastructure, after all, is present given Iran's variety of terrains which make for four seasons to exist simultaneously. They also make for a varied influx of produce all the year round.
We're at the crossroads of the north, south, and east-west trade corridors. This crossroads can be a special place for us in exporting products that are cultivated and created through investment in our country. Energy is abundant in this country. We have a lot of renewable energy. In addition to being one of the world's leading oil and gas producers and having huge reserves, we have renewable energy that can be used organically without generating pollution and with the lowest pollution costs to serve the production and investment. We also have a large and young workforce.
Talking of infrastructure, Iran's Qanat irrigated agricultural heritage systems made Iran the most fertile area in the history of Asia. There was once mass production of grains as well as sugarcane and date palm. And today, just in 2004, Iran's wheat yield reached 14 million tons. This made the country more than self-sufficient as far as land yield goes. It ended the country's 45-year history of importing wheat. Also, it saved the country $1 billion a year in overseas expenditures. Iran may have lost the European market in spite of the high quality of its exports, but it is still exporting to countries such as Iraq, Azerbaijan, and Afghanistan. Iran is the world's biggest producer of pistachio and saffron. Apart from those two products, exports of other agricultural commodities like apples, milk, and vegetables are not economically viable for Iranian exporters.
Regarding Iran's agricultural resources, what they entail and what more must be done about them, there's more to be said. But first, a media review with Shahrzad.
Hi, my name is Shahrzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on food security amid sanctions, Iran's untapped agricultural potentials. In an article by Tehran Times, we explore soil depletion, a neglected issue requiring urgent attention. Soil is one of the most vital non-renewable resources that many organisms on the planet depend on, as it ensures food security of the nations. However, the attention paid to this valuable resource is not as much as its significance. According to the latest statistics, Iran loses 2 billion tons of soil annually, which according to the 2018 report of the United Nations Development Program, the total amount of global soil erosion is 24 billion tons, so 1/12 of all global soil erosion occurs in Iran. This is while Iran has about 1% of the world's land area, which means that its erosion rate is 8 times higher than the global average, so Iran is suffering from severe degradation and soil erosion. To understand the importance of soil protection, it should be said that it takes an average of 400 years to form a centimeter of soil on the planet. Forty Daily reports Iran's food self-sufficiency reaches 81%. Kazem Khabazi, acting Minister of Agriculture of Iran, said, "For the coming year, we have seen the supply of all inputs such as seeds, fertilizers, pesticides, and livestock and poultry supplements, vaccines and serums, and a good work environment." He also added that we have a very close relationship with farmers, and the wheat cultivation program is 6% more than that of last year, and barley cultivation is 16% higher than last year, and rapeseed cultivation is 14% higher than last year. He then added, our self-sufficiency in the food production reached 81% last year, and our forecast is that this number will increase and reach 83% this year, thanks to the efforts of farmers. Tehran Times states Persian Gulf Water Transfer Project inaugurated. In recent years, due to increasing water consumption for drinking, industrial and agricultural purposes, and sometimes consecutive droughts, the central plateau of Iran has been experiencing severe water shortages, especially in big cities like Isfahan, Kerman, Yazd, and Hormozgan. President Hassan Rouhani inaugurated the first phase of Iran's major water desalination and transfer project, which is aimed at supplying Persian Gulf water to central Iran through pipelines. This project is aimed at transmitting Persian Gulf water to Hormozgan, Kerman, and Yazd provinces after being desalinated in a modern desalination plant. With the implementation of this project, the country's desalination capacity is going to increase by 50%. This project aims to promote production, industry, and agriculture, as well as to provide drinkable water to residents in arid areas. Maintaining the country's food security and creating new job opportunities and also maintaining the already existing jobs in industrial and production units are also other merits of the mentioned project. That's all for this segment. We'll see you next week.
In general, Iran's major agricultural exports include fresh and dried fruits, nuts, animal hide, processed foods, caviar, and spices. From the standpoint of value, pistachio, raisins, dates, and saffron are the first four export products. On the relatively new bell pepper farm you've seen me in so far, I got to talk to the farmer who set up his business with a look to exports as well as domestic supply.
From the beginning, I looked at the market, and in Iran nowadays, this product is consumed better. And it is also against the some kind of cancer, so we have to have it in our food, I think. We are exporting more than half of our products to, for example, Russia and in the Persian Gulf region. I think 10% is for domestic use and 90% for export.
A danger to both self-sufficiency and exports that bring foreign currency into the country is unaccounted for imports and exports. That is to say, when people's most basic need becomes a source of astronomical income to the few, and the balance between these three variables is tipped over. Imports, exports, and domestic produce for domestic use.
Our Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade is structured so that it's more willing to import in this regard. The desire to import is extremely high. The interests of many traders, dominating the country's markets and product supply, hinder the development of exports. There are some brokers who are mainly looking for imports because that's how they generate money. Being able to attain licensing for imports and exports is a public right. It must not be given to just a select few. Licenses must be granted to productive cooperatives.
The agricultural sector's share in Iran's non-oil gross domestic product, GDP, reached 8.8% in the previous Iranian calendar year. That's up 3% over 7 years. Once again, the Iranian calendar year begins on March the 21st. There is room for more growth in the agriculture sector, however, by using modern science and new technologies and methods, both technically and in the commercial sector.
In two ways, I think we are going forward. One of them is academical studies, and these academical studies helps us to become a farmer, because I'm not a farmer's son. I'm only an agriculture engineer, but I decided to make this. And the other thing is the sanctions, I think, because these sanctions causes us to pushes us to do it by ourselves.
Now, in spite of all the talk on mechanizing or further modernizing farming, the gardening business, as one branch of the industry, boasts it has mechanized enough to have produced more crop at higher quality and lower, more competitive costs. The agricultural sector at large, however, must become more demand-orientated than supply-orientated in order to make better engineered profit from sales. This is although Iran claims over 95% of the technology and knowledge in this area, that's mechanization, is domestic. A shortcoming for the country is the agricultural industry falls short of raw material production, be it growing grain and fruit or husbanding cattle and farming fish. Gardening has contributed significantly to non-oil exports and creating employment. With an evolved related industry, including packaging methods, it can do yet better.
The ground for attracting foreign investment for agricultural development is provided. Foreigners can make good profits if they invest in fields such as packaging, processing of agricultural products, and many other areas. The point is that Iran is a secure country, and I think investors should take that into consideration. The Iranian government guarantees their original capital and the profit thereof.
Now we can toil all we want, but with climate change and population growth, and now a viral pandemic at large, planning is key to carrying on. Crops and the sustenance and money they secure can only be guaranteed by the health of Mother Earth, her water and soil.
Over the past centuries, due to population growth and the need for food, and not only in Iran but all over the world, we had to take the water out of the ground, build a variety of dams, and allocate more for the urban and industrial use and less for the agricultural sector. Failure to control water consumption patterns in the drinking and industrial sector, locating water-demanding industries such as steel factories away from parts of Iran like the north and the south where we have huge water resources, and instead running them in deserts in central Iran, have all been policies that have jeopardized the country's water balance and water security.
The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, is out to help Iran in this regard, while Iran itself is investing in its youth at knowledge-based companies. This is of paramount importance given major water resources have been desiccated by overuse and excessive deep well digging, beginning with the administration past.
We have no choice but to invest in technology and knowledge-based institutions. The sanctions target both our foreign investment and our ability to import the technology we need. The solution is to take steps similar to other countries that have been sanctioned and threatened. They have relied on domestic resources and not on capital and technology coming from abroad.
The role of watershed management and water distribution management in achieving important statistics in the field of agriculture is significant, but there is yet work to be done. FAO has a project to implement in Iran to assist this country in rehabilitating its soil and water resources and enhancing the resilience of the agriculture system and rural communities, resilience to climate change and climatic disasters. Now, two important water resources to replenish are the Qazvin Plain and Urmia Lake Basin. A prerequisite to doing so is water accounting and mapping evapotranspiration. Water accounting is the process of collecting, analyzing, summarizing, and reporting water-related information. It reveals how water is used across different sectors and helps shape and understand the benefits and existing trade-off of the water allocations and use patterns. And the integrated and cross-sectoral presentation of the information on water accounting helps users, that's decision makers, see the bigger picture. It is important to assess and map agroecological zones and water availability to develop appropriate crop patterns. The development and implementation of different crop patterns contributes to higher land productivity, in other words, increased crop production.
We have several points of view in the Agriculture Commission. One is why, for example, the main livestock feed in our country should be corn, which we can't grow inside Iran. There are plants and fodder that can be grown anywhere without special care in our country, which has a hot and dry climate. We must have an approach toward non-dependency on some inputs. It's not like we make a decision this year and reap the rewards next year. But we can make the right decisions for the coming years, which I think will have a positive outcome.
It is noteworthy as far as self-sufficiency in production and supply goes, the matter of comparative advantage shouldn't be overlooked, hard as that may be with sanctions in place. Because to produce all one needs will in the long term only exhaust the infrastructure to produce agricultural requirements more than it already has. All matters considered, it's the farmer that has to put theory into practice. Our farmer, who is young, unlike a great many, has also, thanks to his college education, fully mechanized his plantation.
In lots of aspects, they are different. One of them is that we have a 7-meter height, and everything is controlled by the smart climate control system, which helps us to use less people to help us, and we are doing these kind of things by hand in the other farms, but in this farm everything is automatically done.
FAO is holding an e-learning program in Iran to equip experts with the knowledge and skills to implement REWAS, REWAS. That's the advanced approach of real water savings. The approach uses the concept of following the water. Given this concept, drainage, runoff, and percolation to the underground are no longer losses, because downstream users can use these recoverable waters. This beauty spot is going to make sure to keep the flow of golden wheat and green bell peppers and red bell peppers going. There's always going to be those who'll make sure of that against all odds. Thanks, bye for now.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Hussein, a book lover and a student of Tarbiyat Mudarris University of Tehran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters across the world, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You've tuned into IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The show is Bookshelf, and I'm Hussein. I'm here if you're looking for an interesting book to read this week. As we search for the truth through history, we reach a point when, although the Islamic nation was once united around Muhammad, they fall into dispute in regards to who his successor is, how a successor should be identified. and what characteristics distinguish a successor from the rest. It's not believable that Muhammad, who carried his diverse, disunited people into an era of unity and a sense of oneness, would not have had the foresight to declare a successor for himself. And it is so. The Prophet has talked a lot about his successors, which shows that he understood the importance of appointing one to keep the nation united. You don't want decades of your hard work ruined because of disputes about who should continue in your position because you didn't make it clear who should. Many narrations exist in both Islamic schools from the Messenger of Islam about his successors. Studying these narrations give a hint, if not making it clear, to who would be the best candidate to succeed the Prophet. Today we want to introduce a book about the narrations pertaining to the issue of Muhammad's successors, from Muhammad himself. Stay tuned.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Bookshelf, and we were talking about the importance of identifying the successor of the Prophet. Today's book is called The 12 Successors of the Holy Prophet by Sayyid Murtaza Al-Askari, published by World Islamic Network. World Islamic Network is a registered public trust under the government of India, established in 1991, with the main objective of imparting true knowledge of Islam to people around the world. The greatest challenge as well as opportunity before the Shia today in this era of media, according to this publication, is to promote the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. So today's book is called The 12 Successors of the Holy Prophet, which you can download for free from al-islam.org. It first begins with a long list of narrations about the number of the successors of the Prophet, offers an analysis of the narrations in the second section, and ends by introducing the 12 Imams. After the break, I'm going to be reading page 11 of this book. You can download it while we're in the break and join us in the reading. Stay tuned.
7 barometer pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
Stay tuned to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Bookshelf, and we're about to read page 11 from the book The 12 Successors of the Holy Prophet, which you can download for free from al-islam.org. Just to give you some context, in this book we've already been given a long list of narrations about the number of the successors of the Prophet and their characteristics. After having discussed the traditions regarding 12 successors, we can derive the following points. The number of imams for this ummah shall be 12 in a continuous line. Secondly, after the 12th of these imams, the world shall reach its end. According to the first tradition, the Islamic religion will continue until the hour has been established, or you have been ruled over the 12 caliphs that have passed among you. This tradition has fixed the period of Islam's supremacy till the day of Qiyamah, or the day of judgment, and also fixed the number of imams for this ummah as 12. According to the fifth tradition, the Islamic religion will continue until there are 12 imams from the Quraysh. And when they all die, the earth will swallow its inhabitants. This tradition proves that Islam will continue till the end of this world, or till the reign of the 12th imam, and after them, this earth shall be destroyed. The eighth tradition limits the number of Imams to 12. After me, there shall be caliphs equal in number to the companions of Musa. The tradition shows that there will be no more than 12 caliphs after the Holy Prophet, and the Messenger of Allah has clarified that the number of caliphs will be limited to 12, and after these 12, the Qiyamah, or the Day of Judgment, will surely occur and the earth shall be destroyed. Other traditions clarify the above statements. On the basis of this, we have to admit that in order to supervise the affairs of humanity, one of the Imams must have a long life, which is an unusual phenomenon. Thus, the 12th Caliph and the successor of the Holy Prophet, that is, Imam Mahdi, was bestowed with a long life. The scholars of the school of Caliphate are at pains to explain the traditions that mention the 12 successors. We present herewith, in brief, their contradictory explanations. Ibn al-Arabi says in the Sharh al-Sunan al-Tirmidhi, "We have counted the emirs after the Holy Prophet as 12. We found them as follows: Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, Ali, Hassan, Muawiyah, Yazid, Muawiyah ibn Yazid, Marwan Abd al-Malik ibn Marwan, Yazid ibn Abd al-Malik, Marwan ibn Muhammad ibn Marwan, As-Safa." After this, there were 27 caliphs from the Bani Abbas. Now, if we consider 12 of them, we can reach only till Sulaiman. If we take the literal meaning, we have only 5 of them, and to these, we add the 4 righteous caliphs and Umar ibn Abd al-Aziz. I cannot understand the meaning of this hadith. Al-Suyuti says, "There are only 12 caliphs until Qiyamah, the Day of Judgment, and they will continue to act on truth even if they are not continuous." It is mentioned in Fath al-Bari that 4 of them, the righteous caliphs, have passed. The rest also must pass before Qiyamah, or the Day of Judgment. Ibn al-Jawzi says, "It can be concluded that the phrase, 'then there will be discord,' implies the disturbing events like the coming of Dajjal and whatever will come after it." Al-Suyuti has explained as follows. We see that from the 12, 4 are the righteous caliphs, then Hassan, then Muawiyah, then Ibn Zubayr, and finally Umar ibn Abdulaziz. They are 8. 4 of them remain. Maybe Mahdi, the Abbasid, could be included, as he is an Abbasid like Umar ibn Abdulaziz was an Umayyad. And Tahir Abbasi will also be included because he was a just ruler. Thus, 2 more are yet to come. One of them is Mahdi because he is from the Ahlul Bayt. It is also said it could also mean that the 12 Imams will remain during the period of Islam's supremacy, the time when Islam will be a dominant religion. These caliphs will, during their tenure, glorify the religion. All the Muslims will collect round them in unison. Al-Bayhaqi says, the number 12 is found till the period of Walid ibn Abd al-Malik. After this, there was chaos and disturbance. Then came the Abbasid dynasty. This report has increased the number of Imams. If we neglect some of their characteristics which came after the disturbance, then their number will be much higher.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
That's all the time that I have, unfortunately. The book is only 22 pages, but you can already see how informative it is. If you missed it, we introduced the book, The 12 Successors of the Holy Prophet by Sayyid Murtadha Al-Askari, translated by Al-Qaram Translators and Writers Bureau. You can download the book from al-islam.org. And if you missed our program, you can always download an archive of this episode and our previous episodes from our website. Simply search IRIB English Radio Bookshelf. Until next week, and a lot of reading. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.